listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The prohibition of torture and ill treatment has been severely undermined by policies and practices in areas such as counterterrorism or extraordinary renditions or irregular migrations.
That was the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Niles Meltzer, discussing the case of missing Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, referring to the practices employed mostly by the U.S. since September 11, 2011.
Policies that are perceived to bring short-term benefits but actually are implemented at the cost of seriously weakening the protection of human rights and the rule of law, and even public security and safety in the long run.
The UN Special Rapporteur said it was up to the governments of Saudi Arabia and Turkey to resolve the situation over Khashoggi's death, and that if they failed to do so, perhaps then it might be appropriate for outsiders to get involved in the case.
If no solution can be found in conducting a credible and objective investigation on that level, then perhaps at some point international mechanisms should get involved. I think we're a little bit early in the process to come to a definite conclusion there, because obviously this is a very delicate issue. And I think we should give the involved states time under public scrutiny to come to a conclusion that they want to address this problem.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met Tuesday with Saudi Arabia's King Salman over the disappearance and apparent slaying of the Saudi writer, who vanished 2 weeks ago after entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul for some documents pertaining to his then-pending marriage. Earlier this week, President Donald Trump spoke with the King of Saudi Arabia, who denied any involvement in the disappearance of Khashoggi. The president said the following to Fox Business Network's Trish Reagan.
Number one, what happened, but whether or not they knew about it. If they knew about it, that would be bad. If they didn't know about it, bad things can happen. But we're going to learn a lot about it. Now, one thing I have to say, they made the largest order in the history of our country for outside of our country, mm-hmm. for weapons, for any kinds of military weapons, mm-hmm. missile systems, ships. They're buying
from us.
From us. $110 billion they're purchasing. It's 500,000 jobs, American jobs. Everything's made here. Okay, so now people say, well, we want to have you end that order. Well, aren't we just hurting our own country? Because here's what's going to happen. They're going to say, hey, America won't sell us the missiles. We'll buy them from China or we'll buy them from Russia. Ours are better, much better. They'll say, America won't sell us the ships. America won't sell us the arms that we need. What we'll do is we'll buy them from Russia, China, and there are some others, France. You know, there are
and so
others.
They benefit financially, and they might then have a more strategic relationship, too, with those countries.
You have senators and congressmen say, oh, if they did that, we should punish them by not selling them equipment. Well, if we don't sell them the equipment, they'll buy lesser quality equipment because we make it's so much better than anybody else. But they'll buy it from Russia, they'll buy it from China. So we're not really hurting them, we're hurting ourselves. So we want to be smart. I don't want to give up a $110 billion order or whatever it is. It's the largest order ever given by an outside country, okay? And I don't want to give that up. You're talking about jobs. What I'm doing here, we've created an incredible economy. I want Boeing and I want Lockheed and I want Raytheon to take those orders and to hire lots of people to make that incredible equipment.
Well,
you understand.
I get it, but it's complicated stuff. And, you know, you're looking at jobs here at home and a lot of money for American companies versus what certainly seems as pretty atrocious. Now, we don't know everything, but
we don't know.
I mean, these are the decisions that you face as president.
Let's hope we hear the proper answers.
Last week's spectacular save of the Soyuz disaster brought news with it of previous Russian successes in the midst of failure. Despite the failure of the boosters, the Russian and American aboard Soyuz did not die and were hardly injured. But you can hear that in their own words. This is RT journalist Igor Zhdanov speaking with Russian cosmonaut Alexei Ovchinin in an exclusive interview with RT, and that's followed with an RT interview with NASA astronaut Nick Hague.
Well, Rory, indeed, we do have a very special guest. I do have a very special guest here with me in the studio, Alexei Ovchinin, one of the two persons on board of that Soyuz rocket that was supposed to head into orbit, well, on Thursday, but that didn't happen. There was a rocket failure, so the crew had to make an emergency landing some 700 kilometers or so away from the Baikonur Cosmodrome. And I have, as I've said, Alexei Ovchinin right here with me. Just to warn you, I will be speaking in Russian. The interview will be in Russian, but of course we do have a translator standing by for you, so we can now begin, I think. So, Alexei Nikolaevich,
Alexei, thank you so much for joining us today. So, what was happening aboard the Soyuz when the launch went wrong?
Well, the situation became an emergency. We noticed it by the emergency signals blinking, and we instantly realized what had happened. And from then on, it was the automatics of the spacecraft, and we were doubling its activities as the crew.
So we started getting the first pictures when we had the live broadcast during the launch. We had a moment when we saw that the capsule you were in was shaking heavily, and the signal was there was a disruption in the signal. Was this exactly the time when you realized, or was it something nominal at that stage?
When everything goes according to plan, when the first stage is detached, there's always this kind of vibration that you can see on video images. That's normal. But after the first stage detached, we felt vibration. Vibrations continue, and then immediately there was the emergency signal going off, and we realized that this was an emergency.
So when that system went off and when you saw the lights blinking, indicating there was a failure, it's your second flight. So what was the first thought that came to your mind? So you know you've trained for 10 years, so you've been prepared for it, but what was the first thing that came to your mind?
Что не пригодятся никогда в жизни, но здесь пригодились. Вот первая мысль ваша в тот момент.
What was the first idea?
Well, once we had the emergency signal, we realized that this flight will have to be aborted and that will have to go down by a ballistic trajectory.
Well, you said that it was all done automated and you just kept track of what was happening. So you were the commander of the pair. What depends on you?
Like I said, after the emergency was signaled, the emergency rescue system automatically switched on, and depending on which stage of the launch the emergency happens, and there are three stages all in all, the emergency rescue system works according to a certain algorithm. At the moment of the emergency, during our liftoff, the main mast carrying the carrier rocket, it had been detached already, but the boosters were still there, which continued to work after the emergency. And after the pod separated and there was the emergency separation, from the boosters, then the various parts of the module separated from each other, and then the cyclogram went in, and the pods went into a landing according to a ballistic trajectory. The crew controls this signal system, and we have a handle called RUS, which we have to use to give certain commands to double the activities of the automatic emergency system, and that's what we were doing in accordance with the drills, and everything went in accordance with the contingency plans. So there was this ballistic trajectory landing, landing on a parachute detachment, and then we prepared for landing.
Well, for Nick Hague, this was his maiden flight. Did you discuss it with him? I mean, not just the technical, professional discussion. Did you discuss it from a personal point of view?
I must say that Nick did very well throughout our flight, which lasted a little over 19 minutes, from liftoff to landing. At all stages, he was engaged, he was supportive, he was helping me, he was responding to conversations from Earth, from the ground station, and after we landed and we were recovered by the search and rescue team, I didn't see him either frightened, so he did very well. He acted in a professional way, and I believe our crew was tightly knit and working well together, and I would like very much to take my next flight with Nick.
Well, you said 19 minutes, slightly more than 19 minutes. Okay. How much time did you spend in that recovery capsule, and what did you do during that ballistic reentry?
Exactly all of those 19 minutes, and sometime after landing, we were inside the landing pod until the search and rescue team, who parachuted down to get us out, they landed next to the pod, and they helped us out of the pod. They also worked very quickly, very professionally. After we landed, I called the search and rescue aircraft and then the search and rescue helicopter. We established radio communication with them, and we were permanently in touch, and so we had a good idea who would be doing what.
You've been trained to endure 6-7G, if I understand.
A little under 7G.
So what kind of feelings do you have? What do you experience? Can you share it with us so that an untrained personnel layman would understand what is all about? What can you compare it with?
Well, you could compare it, first of all, it can work in various directions. The gravity forces can go in various directions. The crew who are in their special seats, usually you feel the pressure with your chest and your back. When there is increased gravity, you could compare it with a block of concrete being put on your chest, and then with 7G, its weight would be 7 times your weight. So take your weight and multiply it by 7. If you weigh 90 kilos, you would weigh 7 times as much, and you would have that weight of concrete lying on your chest.
Well, it sounds incredibly huge.
It is actually bearable. When you train and when you pass medical tests, we train on a centrifuge, and it has a standard pressure of 8G. So crew members usually have an idea of what it's going to feel like, how you're supposed to breathe in such a situation, what you're supposed to do. So this wasn't the first time for us, and we were ready.
RT, together with Roscosmos, did a TV show called Start. It's a 40-minute program sharing exciting stories, telling the audience about the launch. Thank you for taking part in it. You responded to some of our questions, and there were stupid questions, I must admit, but there was a question, are you afraid to fly? And you said you're not afraid to fly, but you're afraid when you do not fly. Do you still think the same?
Yes, my opinion has not changed the way I feel about it. After landing, Nick and myself, we feel fine. We have passed medical tests, not once actually, several times, and the medics agree that we are fine physically. As for our mental state, we are ready to continue space flights, and so after there's been an explanation of what actually happened, I'm hoping that we will take a flight in the nearest time. We would like that very much.
Talking of psychology, this was a heavy test for you and for your family. We talked to Svetlana, your spouse, who was in Star City at that moment. What do they think about your future flights? It's impossible to get prepared for such a phenomenal situation like the one happened on Thursday.
Well, my family members, after they have been through this situation, next time it will be more difficult for them to let me go, to let me take such a space flight, because obviously they've been scared. But on the other hand, they are confident in our equipment, in the way we're in our training, in what we're prepared for. Anything can happen. This is hardware we're talking about, but we are prepared, and this is our job. We cannot stop at what we've done. We need to move on.
Your mother met you at Baikonur when you landed. What was the first thing you told her, and she told you?
I told her not to worry. I said I was okay. I said my health was in good condition. I said, look at me, I'm walking. Nothing is broken, so don't be frightened. And after she saw me with her own eyes, she calmed down. So that's how it was.
What about your wife?
With my wife, I called her almost immediately after landing. We had a satellite phone in our pod specifically for cases like that, for situations like that. And after we were recovered from the pod, we took out the satellite phone. I immediately called our superiors. I told them that we were alive and well. I told them our whereabouts. I told them that we had been recovered by the search and rescue team. And then I called my wife and told her that I was fine. She learned that there had been an emergency situation, but she had no specific information on, and I calmed her down. And after that, I called, and then our superiors also started calling our relatives to calm them down.
Now, staying on what you said first, I remember that you said it was a quick one. So did the sense of humor help you?
Well, I wouldn't say there was any irony in this. It was more humor, somewhat laced with pity, because we realized that our mission had to be aborted and our space flight would not be going on. We had spent 18 months with Nick training for this flight, and this would have been his first space flight. It was second for me, and I remembered how you prepare for your first space mission and the feelings that you have. Some things that you have to feel yourself. When you hear about it from someone else, it's not enough. I'm hoping that we will try it once again, and we'll get all those positive emotions that we were supposed to get.
Now, from the statements by Roscosmos, next spring in April, we will have next flights where you will fly with possibly Nick. Well, you're an experienced one, and you've been training for this flight for 187 days. So will you spend it on training? How will you spend it? What will you do during that period?
I'm hoping that I will spend fewer than 187 days down here on Earth. As soon as we start, as soon as we're done analyzing the emergency situation, the dates for further launches will be identified, and as soon as that happens, we'll start preparing for our next space flight, and it'll be clear by that time what kind of training, what kind of preparation we'll have to undergo. Of course, we immediately will start training in order to be prepared by the time we need to launch and to be in an even better shape.
Going back to the emergency safety system, it worked flawlessly. And again, this was the first incident in more than 30 years. So how would you assess the performance of the system and the search and rescue systems too?
First of all, I'd like to thank the designers, the constructors, the architects of our space craft, all those people involved in the preparations of the space mission, and all the medics who were involved in the rescue mission, the space and the search and rescue team, the medics who saw to us after we had been recovered. Like you said, for 35 years there haven't been such an emergency, but this did not play a role, because the people involved in the search and rescue, they acted very swiftly and professionally, and I have nothing but thanks for them. And for my part, myself personally and other people, we have been reaffirmed in our confidence that our hardware works, and that we shouldn't be afraid that when need be, our hardware will work properly.
Did you get in contact with the ISS? Did you talk to Sergei, who is up there? So we've been talking to him. He was waiting for you just before the launch. He said that they've been really waiting for you. He even made a meal for you. Did you talk to him?
We did get in touch. Sergey called, and we had a conversation. I told him I was all right, that my health was well. He was sorry that we hadn't made it to the ISS because we were carrying presents for the crew of the station. But it was also interesting because the guys were taking pictures of our liftoff from the ISS, and they actually managed to capture the moment of the emergency of the abortion of our flight. So it was interesting to saw those. I hope that the next crew will be going to the ISS as soon as possible, and the ISS program, the experiments, the scientific work, and the activities to keep the station operational will continue.
The Russian Space Agency said they might push the date of the next launch earlier to early December. Thank you so much, Mr. Avchinin, for sitting down with us and sharing how it all happened. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was RT's journalist Igor Zhdanov speaking with Russian cosmonaut Alexei Avchinin about his adventure last week after the failure of a rocket that was intended to lift him and his American partner Nick Hague from NASA to the International Space Station. This was Nick Hague speaking about that same event.
You know, the first 2 minutes of the launch were going great. Everything was nominal, and it was right after the first staging when the booster started to separate inside. It went from normal to something was wrong pretty quick. The automated system pulled us away from the rocket so fast, and so the first thing I really noticed was being shaken fairly violently side to side as that safety system pulled us away from the rocket. And then there was an alarm inside the capsule and a light that was up there, and you know, I knew once I saw that light that we had an emergency with the booster, that at that point we weren't going to make it to orbit that day. So the mission changed to getting back down on the ground as safely as we could. The first frame or two before the feed cuts from the capsule of us being shaken side to side, you know, it continued for a little while after that before it settled out, and then it was kind of a slow coasting ride to the top of our ballistic trajectory. So there were a couple things that happened at the top. I got to experience a few seconds of weightlessness, and I was able to watch a few things float around in the capsule. Our zero-G indicators that we had hanging with us were floating around. I was also able to look out the window. You know, primarily to make sure, hey, are we in a good attitude? Are we stable? Are we ready to come back down? But also look out the window and realize, you know, looking down at the curvature of the Earth and out into the blackness of space and realizing I got close, but it wasn't going to be this time. So everything was new for me. It was my first time. So I have to give kudos to my commander, Alexei Avchinin. He's a seasoned a veteran cosmonaut. And as we were going through this, he was able to tell me, you know, what was normal, what was not normal. Obviously, a ballistic descent, we come up and we're coming back down in a fairly steep trajectory. And to lose all of that energy, it all ends up being absorbed as wind resistance and G. And so the G's built up pretty fast. Luckily, we didn't have the 6 to 7 G's for very long. It was only a handful of seconds, and then things were back down to normal. From that point, after that peak of G, it's a normal Soyuz landing. And so everything went nominal from that point on. So I've been in the centrifuge. I've felt what 6, 7 G's feels like. They take us all the way up to 8 G's when we're doing the training. Then, you know, the other aspect is we are in a capsule that looks just like the real thing. It's actually old parts that they've scavenged from previous vehicles. And so when you're sitting in there and the simulations and the emergencies are going off and the alarms are sounding and you're making all the switch throws, it feels just like you're there. And that was one of the comments I had to Alexei when we were sitting there before launch, is this feels just like the simulator. So it's a very comfortable feeling because you've spent so many hours inside there. You know where every switch is at by memory. You really don't have to look to be able to find what you're after. We looked at each other. We had grins from ears to ears. You can imagine the scene. We're in the capsule. We're kind of hanging upside down from our straps because of the orientation of the capsule. And we look at each other, big grins. He holds out a hand. I shake his hand. And then we start cracking a few jokes between us about how short our flight was. Funny story, we're sitting there next to the capsule after we've landed, and we're trying to make all the phone calls on our satellite phone that we're supposed to make, and then after that we start trying to get in touch with loved ones. So after Alexei was able to speak with his wife, I called mine, and unfortunately it went to voicemail. So now she has she's got a voicemail that she can keep as a memento for the rest of her life. I imagined that my first trip to outer space was going to be a memorable one. I didn't expect it to be quite this memorable. But it's what we do is hard. And it's not something that I think you can state enough. What do we mean when we say space is hard, human exploration of space is hard? There's risk, and we do everything we can to mitigate that risk, but there's always some risk there. The designers, the engineers, the people that build these spacecraft, they're constantly trying to make the perfect spacecraft, but it can't be perfect all the time. So we have contingencies in place, and we have other fail-safe systems. And this was just a great example of those fail-safe systems stepping in and doing their job. We hadn't had to use those on the Soyuz in 35 years, and it was still ready to go when it was needed. And so for that, I'm very thankful for all those people that invested so much in making sure that those fail-safe systems are in place. So I'm not concerned with the Soyuz. Obviously, I'm very interested in what's developing with commercial crew and getting that there. And I've mentioned that before in previous interviews. It provides us as a program with a robust means to get astronauts and cosmonauts to the space station so that if we have a problem with one vehicle, we can still deliver on time and not have to do the types of things that we might need to do if we've got delays with one particular vehicle. So I'm excited to see that progress continue, but I'm also very confident in the Soyuz to be able to continue to deliver crew members to the station. So we actually had to stay in a hospital in Baikonur overnight for observation. And I'm laying there in the hospital bed, and I get a phone call from Alex and Serena on board. And they were giving me a hard time, saying that they were eating my dinner that they had prepared for me and had waiting for me. But we joked around a little bit, and they're in a situation up there that they didn't expect to be in, being up there short a few crewmates. And it's going to make life more challenging for them over the next few months, but there's a team on the ground of thousands that are making it possible and arranging things to give them the support that they need. So they're going to be great.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. After repeated denials, the Saudis are now expected to change their story on the fate of Jamal Khashoggi. Was he the victim of abduction and torture that went too far? Donald Trump has expressed concern, but little more. Some are saying Riyadh could get away with murder. Crosstalking a Saudi crisis, I'm joined by my guest, Sharmeen Narwani in Beirut. She is a journalist as well as a Middle East geopolitical expert. In Tehran, we have Mohammed Mirandi. He's a professor at the University of Tehran. And in Washington, we have Ali Al-Ahmed. He is a founder and director of the Institute of Gulf Affairs. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Mohammed, let me go to you first in Tehran with a hypothetical. Let's say there's a hypothetical dissident against the Iranian government living abroad and goes to an Iranian consulate and never comes out. What kind of news story would that be, and what would the reaction be? Because living in Russia, I can tell you, Russia gets accused of things and sanctions are done before we could even finish a program here. So what would your reaction to my hypothetical situation be? Go ahead, Mohammed.
Well, it's obvious. We would be probably discussing the UN Security Council meeting that would be taking place to condemn Iran or perhaps almost any other country in the world. But when it comes to Saudi Arabia, the double standards are extraordinary. In fact, what I would what I think is even the biggest question, in fact, is that the Saudis have been killing hundreds of thousands of people in Yemen through starvation and disease, and tens of thousands of people through warfare. They've bombed weddings, they've bombed schools, they've bombed funerals, they've bombed hospitals, they've bombed buses. Just again, I think yesterday or a while back, they bombed another bus, and there's I think 17 people were killed, and there's no real reaction. So when poor Jamal is killed, suddenly there's this outrage, which there are reasons behind this. But when all these other people are killed, yeah, I think the issue with Jamal is that Mohammed bin Salman didn't recognize that Jamal was too well connected. He knew too many people. He was friends with too many people. Thanks to the Saudis, for many years the Saudis had funded him. He knew everyone. He'd invite people to Saudi Arabia. People felt they couldn't be quiet after he went missing, because they would look like fools. And then I think in addition to that, the divisions in the United States made it even worse for Mohammed bin Salman, because many people are attacking Trump and they're using Mohammed bin Salman in order to attack
exactly.
Trump. So I think if there was a different president, we wouldn't have this situation.
You know, Charmaine, I mean, it's a really obvious thing to address here. I mean, Mike Pompeo, as I understand, is now in Riyadh. Now, the crown prince is the nominal leader of the country, or I should say the family, the royal family. If he was involved and had knowledge of this, then he was involved in a murder. If he didn't know, well, then it's just as bad. So he has rogue elements in his security forces. I mean, I don't see any way, real explanation for this whatsoever. We need to know. And then the Turks chime in here. They say they have all the forensic evidence. We remain waiting to see that there. But I mean, I don't see any logical way out of explaining the fate of this man here. But I'm sure Mike Pompeo, because it's all about oil and power, there's going to be some kind of resolution. And I think all of us will say hypocrisy. Go ahead, Charmaine, in Beirut.
Well, it's true, you know, when the first report started to come out, and I was astonished that the Western mainstream media jumped on the story and took it where they did,
because they didn't care about Yemen. No, but it was because of the Washington Post. I think that was the reason why. Keep going. Go ahead.
One just assumed that Jamal was killed and, dismembered. That's the news that was coming out. But then very quickly you saw that what was coming out from unknown or unnamed Turkish sources was not being reflected in what Turkish officials and Erdogan were saying on the record. So immediately you could see there was a leverage game being played out here. You started to see, hang on, wait a second, maybe there's a larger picture here. Maybe Turkey and Qatar are going to sort of squeeze the Saudi stone as much as they can to get some concessions or cash out of the Saudis. But, you know, where there's concessions and cash to be made, Trump is never going to be far from that negotiation. And so, of course, now Pompeo is taking the lead to try to frame what happened. But I don't think he's going to be successful. I think there's just been too many stories, and the feeling has turned.
I agree with you. That's why I love that. They're going to try to frame it in a certain way. And I ended my question to you with the word hypocrisy. Ali, let me go to you in Washington. I mean, it seems to me that when we heard that there was a joint Turkish-Saudi investigation, the first thing that went to my mind was, no, this is not an investigation. This is a negotiation, exactly what Sharmeen had to say, how they're going to resolve it. And I'm sure Erdogan and Qatar, they have a huge smile across their face. I mean, they are getting concessions. It'd be very interesting what they are. Go ahead, Ali.
Yes, I agree with Sharmeen's assessment. That's my assessment as well, that there is, there was talk of releasing the audio, shows the exact murder and who was involved and the details and everything, but it was withheld to negotiate a settlement, and the settlement will be, it's a transnational settlement. The U.S., like Sharmeen said, Pompeo is not in Riyadh to ask about Jamal Khashoggi. He's in Riyadh to say how much are we getting, what's our cut. And the Qataris, I think, are part of this as well, because we have reports that Adel Jubeir was in Doha just last night to make some arrangements. And the Turks are actually getting a lot of investments from the Saudis. They need it at this time. So, yes, there is a settlement being made to give Saudi Arabia an out. And everybody else is going to make money or get concessions from the Saudis. So, and Jamal is fate is going to be basically hidden. They will frame it in a certain way, like Sharmeen said, absolutely. And I think it will be blamed on the rogue elements. They already said that they are questioning the 15 Saudis who were in Turkey during the time Jamal went missing.
Okay, Mohammed, I just want to make it clear for the record here. The initial response of Saudi Arabia is that Jamal left the consulate safe and sound. There was no evidence of that, no CCTV footage. Then the next part of their story, their official story, is that they want to change their story. We don't know exactly what that is right now. I want to set the record straight that there is the Saudi side to all of this. Mohammed, why would Saudi security services want to kill him? Why? I mean, if they want, they had him, and I'm just being hypothetical here. I mean, he was in the consulate. They could have abducted him. I assume they probably could have got him out of the country. Why, if he is dead, why would they want to kill him? Go ahead.
You know, that's a very good question, and I think under normal circumstances and for normal people, it would make sense, the question. That would be the first thing that comes to mind. How foolish could they be in committing such a crime in such a way? But we all have to remember that this is the same person who last year had this Davos in the desert in the Ritz, and then a week later, after all these investors left, they turned it into a prison for billionaires and princes to drive away any hope for any investment. Then we had, of course, the Yemeni war, which he's lost and he won't let go. And I think with what's happened, it's going to empower the Yemenis, by the way. I think this is going to make the situation in Yemen much worse for the Saudis, because they're going to have a stronger hand at the negotiating table when this all finally ends. But then we also had the kidnapping of the Lebanese prime minister. That doesn't make sense. None of these things make sense. Then we had, of course, Qatar as well, and the stupidity of the Saudis with the Canadians. None of this makes sense. And I think probably the best explanation that I can think of, at least, is that Mohammed bin Salman is this billionaire, son of a billionaire. He's spoiled. He's sort of like Uday, the eldest son of Saddam Hussein, out of control. And I think no one really around him dares to tell him that his ideas are foolish. They're all yes men. They want to keep their status, and they don't want to have a fate like that of Jamal's. So, you know, it doesn't make sense what they do, but this is Mohammed bin Salman, and this is what we've seen over the past year and a half. It's a lot of what he does doesn't make sense.
Okay, let me go to Sharmeen before we go to the break here. I wouldn't put it beyond doubt that there will be some kind of purge in the Saudi security forces, because, of course, that's how it wasn't, quote unquote, my fault, it was their fault. Do you see something like that happening, a purge? Go ahead, Sharmeen, in Beirut.
Well, we don't know what the end result is, how they're going to frame this, who they're going to blame it on, how they're going to sweep it under the rug. But I think it's too far gone. I think Mohammed bin Salman is baked. I don't think anyone's going to see him in a different light. You know, no amount of PR is going to put him in another light again, is going to resuscitate his image. And, I mean, this guy's created so many problems in Saudi Arabia. As you know, we have 10 fingers and thumbs. We don't have enough fingers to put in the dikes. You know, all the water that's spilling out of Saudi Arabia, you know, from Yemen to Syria to even Iraq to domestic things, to the Aramco, the failed Aramco IPO initiative. You know, Saudi Arabia is running out of money. There's, you know, these kind of domestic disputes and imprisonments, et cetera, going on. I hope after the break we can have a chance.
You're right. Let me jump in here. We're going to go to a hard break, and after that break, we'll continue our discussion on Saudi Arabia. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Ali in Washington. Charmaine brought it up on the first part of the program. The Crown Prince for 2 years has been on a charm offensive. I think it's probably safe to assume a very, very, maybe the most expensive charm offensive in PR terms ever. Is it in tatters now? I mean, if the story... I guess we should call it framing this program. If they frame it in a certain way that is not credible, that is not believable, Charmaine went through all of the issues, and so did Professor Morandi, of what's gone wrong under this man's reign. I mean, is there any way he can recover it from it? And what I take a little bit of pleasure in this, if there's anything, to see all these think tanks and people that take all this money to essentially read the script that they're given. I mean, there's a lot of red-faced people right now, and they deserve it, okay? And I hope it stays that way, because you have to start looking at the realities in a principled way in the Middle East. What's going on now is just nonsense. Go ahead, Ali.
There are still people trying to whitewash him. Just the other day, the gentleman from Princeton, somebody I know, was saying that, yeah, Mohammed bin Salman is not a political reformer, but he's definitely a social and economic reformer. He let women drive. Oh, boo-ha-ha, that's important, I guess. But he can kill thousands of children in Yemen and murder journalists and take hostages. And that's okay, because he let women drive. There is continuing to be whitewashing from the business and the prepaid think tank and the Thomas Friedmans of the world for this dictator. And they have done it before to other Saudi leaders. So that will never go away. I think it will be harder now to sell him as such. And the reaction that happened here in America after the Khashoggi disappearance and murder has been the greatest ever I have seen, I've known about, in terms of American reaction to anything related to Saudi Arabia. And it's selective, definitely, because it does not extend to the Yemeni, to the murders in Yemen. I think the MBS will continue to be the leader, and he's not going to come to Washington anytime soon, but he will continue to be the leader, because he's just simply the guy in charge. And no one can dislodge him, regardless of what some Americans are trying to in the administration say. Oh, let's bring back his cousin. Oh, his cousin is not any better than he is. Maybe actually he's better than his cousin, who is an ISIS backer.
Yeah, let me go to Muhammad. I mean, again, you know, this neocolonial attitude. Maybe we should bring back his brother. Wow. Have they learned anything about forced regime change around the world here? Well, Muhammad, one of the things I found fascinating and really quite saddening, if not disgusting, is that the American media angle about it is weapons and jobs. I mean, Jamal's fate is almost an epiphenomenon to all of this here. And seeing to be honest with our viewers here, all of these arms deals are just, they're memorandums of understanding. It's just, we're thinking about buying this, we're thinking about selling you this. Anyway, it's not as far along as everybody thinks. And I'm really kind of stunned by Donald Trump's reaction to it all, because he's walking into a trap set by his enemies here. We'll see. Go ahead, Muhammad.
Well, Trump is, you know, he's no different from previous presidents. He has no I don't think there's no issue of morality for him. But previous presidents were a bit more hypocritical. The Americans, I mean, Brennan, for example, the former CIA director, has been speaking about how awful Mohammed bin Salman is, but things were all right when they were funding ISIS. Things were all right when Turkey and Saudi Arabia were cooperating together in funding ISIS, helping Al-Qaeda. It was fine when they were massacring people in Yemen during the previous U.S. administration under Obama. This is just sheer hypocrisy. And one of the most hypocritical things is how, for example, just I think the other day in The Atlantic, someone wrote that, you know, the United States is no longer supporting what's right. The United States never was supporting what's right. They are the problem in this region. I mean, if it wasn't for the United States, the Saudis wouldn't have been able to do all this horrible stuff. It sort of reminds me of what happened when Iraq invaded Kuwait. Before Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, there was nothing. The Americans said nothing about chemical weapons. And I remember as soon as he went into Kuwait, George Bush, the father, went on TV and said, this monster, he gassed his own people and he gassed Iranians. Whereas George Bush knew quite well that his own government, that he was one of the people involved in giving and enabling Saddam Hussein to acquire chemical weapons and to use those chemical weapons against Iranians and against his own people. So, you know, this is sheer hypocrisy. Some pundits, they say, you know, they sort of try to say, Mohammed bin Salman is like Putin or he's like Iran. No, there's no moral equivalence. Saudi Arabia has created great evil in this region. They've created ISIS. They've destroyed Syria. And Western countries are equally guilty of all this. And the reason why the United States or the U.S. government and Trump is supporting Mohammed bin Salman right now even is because of Israel. The Israelis want him to remain in power because of the so-called deal of the century. And it's because of Syria. And it's because of Iran. So the United States they say we have shared interests now, but not shared values. Well, no, the United States has shared values with Saudi Arabia. We saw it in Yemen. We saw it in Syria. We saw it in Libya. We saw it in Iraq. And we saw it in Afghanistan. And now we see it with poor Jamal. If you recall, last year on this show, Jamal was really trying to defend Saudi Arabia.
Yes, he was.
This person, less than a year ago on your show, was trying to defend Saudi Arabia. And I told him that you can't even go back to your own country.
Yep, I remember. And that's why I have you and Charmaine on the program, because Charmaine was also with us here. Charmaine, let me go back to you.
And I want to chime in here.
Go ahead.
I want to just chime in. Go ahead. That Jamal to the end of his life, was a defender of the monarchy. He just criticized Mohammed bin Salman. And he thought of my work and other dissidents' work as garbage, and he even said bad things about us. So he was a defender. The only reason that they killed him, because he was, for decades, was their defender. And when he started turning against them, they said, we don't want any defections, so we need to make an example of this guy who thinks he can defect, and only absolute loyalty is acceptable to us. That's why this happened in this horrific way.
Charmaine, I've come across this, what we just heard from Ali here. I mean, one of the first things I came across when people analyzing it, I mean, not in the lamestream, stupid Western media, but I mean actual analysts of the region, is that one reason for all of this is exactly for what Ali had to say, is that Jamal was an example, a very horrific example. If indeed he is dead, we cannot say that on this program because we don't have the evidence yet. I have to be very careful in using evidence that we know. But if indeed he was killed, was that the ultimate message to dissent inside and outside of the kingdom? Go ahead, Charmaine.
Well, we know that Mohammed bin Salman does actually think that way, that he is a persona in the Saudi regime that believes in punishing people. And there was this piece written this week by Ben Rhodes, senior advisor to former President Obama. And, you know, he sort of launches into this anecdote where during Obama's last trip in April 2016 to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They were, you know, American officials were lined up on one side of the room, Saudi officials on the other side, seated, while King Salman and Obama had some words about shared objectives, goals, and then Obama brought up the 47 Saudis who had been executed recently, including the prominent Shia cleric Nimr al-Nimr, and just completely randomly, Mohammed bin Salman, who's sitting halfway down the Saudi row, and this never happens in these kind of meetings, only the principals engage with each other, he sort of stands up and says, "You don't understand." He says this to Obama. He says, "You don't understand Saudi justice. The Saudis demand vengeance, okay? They demand vengeance, and these people need to be killed for the security of Saudi Arabia." So this man is predisposed to this kind of thinking, which is why I really want to underline, I do not think he's going to get away from with this. I'm not saying tomorrow he'll be kicked out, but he has plenty of enemies within the kingdom. He has now, you know, split in effect the U.S. Political establishment that's always been pro-Saudi, because half of them really want to take Trump down with this as well. But, you know, something really important I need to say about Mohammed bin Salman. He's not this young, new generation guy who just popped up on the scene. Mohammed bin Salman is part of a project in the Persian Gulf. And it's a project initiated by Mohammed bin Zayed of Abu Dhabi, the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, who wanted basically to bring this guy up the ranks because he knew he could control him. He could get this guy with his simmering rage and their common views on Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood and you know, their right to dominate the region, to sort of set him loose with Saudi money paying for all of it. And as we see in the UAE now, in Yemen now, the UAE is colonizing parts of Yemen, which is, you know, not what the Saudis want. So, you know, they have different agendas, but Mohammed bin Salman was brought in basically up the ranks by Mohammed bin Zayed in Abu Dhabi, and Jared Kushner kind of midwived his ascendance
That's a really good way of putting it.
You know?
Let me give Ali the last word on the program. Ali, the Crown Prince, many in Washington say he may be an SOB, but he's our SOB. That's why he will ride it out. 20 seconds. Go ahead, Ali.
Exactly. Just Jane Kirkpatrick said it, and this is the American policy. If he's our friend, he can do whatever he wants. And you can see today the smiles between Saudi MBS and Pompeo of the United States. It just tells you that they are going to continue to support him. They supported King Abdullah before him, who abuses his own daughters, but he's called a reformer, a woman rights champion. So this is nothing new. We have heard this before. But I have to say, this is the strongest American reaction to anything that's to do with Saudi Arabia, and I give Trump credit for speaking out. Mm-hmm. Obama didn't say that. He still continued to stay silent. Same thing as Clinton. They
said
nothing
about
this affair.
I have to jump in here. We've run out of time. It's this really, at the end of the day, it's the death of outrage, unfortunately. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, Beirut, and in Tehran. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.